You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
We passed about 10 of these billboards of my massive face and just everywhere. And he was sitting in his little bucket seat in the back on the drive home going, "Daddy, Daddy." And I thought, this is what it must be like to be Saddam Hussein's son.
Welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and my thanks, as ever, to The Place Hotel in Edinburgh for allowing us some recording space. And when the regular recording space that we used there, this Fringe, was occupied, they managed somehow to shoehorn myself and my guest, who is not a small man, into a sort of a a very intimate double bedroom some floors up. Hidden away in the building. So thank you very much to The Place Hotel in Edinburgh for allowing us to record there. So to my guest, Jack Doherty is someone who will be known to many of you. He's had a very expansive and unusual career, taking in not only his membership of the sketch group The Bodgers, with whom he came to the Fringe in 1980. And we'll talk a little bit about how the Edinburgh Fringe has changed since that time. But he was also a key member of Absolutely, a sketch show very much beloved to people my age, and the resulting spin-off series Mr. Don and Mr. George, vast chunks of which are still quoted by myself and my little brother to this day. I know there was a lot of excited mentioning of quotes on the ComCom Facebook page when I told you that Jack was going to be on the show. So here is the interview. No extra content from this one. It was a brisk 50 minutes. Very, very grateful to Jack for appearing, as well as to everyone, Katie at the Gilded Balloon and everyone in the press office there that helped set this interview up. You will hear throughout that I am struggling to contain myself, such as my gushing fanboy admiration for Jack. I hope that we managed to get a decent interview out of this. I'm sure we did. But apologies if at some points you could just hear me giddily reciting material back to him that he no longer remembers. So without further ado, this is the fabulous and very funny Jack Doherty. Let's start with your current run here at the Edinburgh Festival. When was the last time you were here at the festival?
I was last here 25 years ago when I did a show with Murray Hunter off of the telly show Absolutely.
And was that the Mr. Don and Mr. George? That was just the two of you?
That was just the two of us, although we were doing those characters, but also other characters from Absolutely, and also being ourselves.
And that was 25, because I saw that. I saw that. I've been coming here since I was 16. It was out of town.
It was at the Churchill Theatre.
The Churchill. I saw that show. There's no record of it apparently exists online. I was trying to work out the year.
It was 93.
That's ridiculous. Yeah. This is my 25th year at the festival.
You must have seen that one. We went out. We thought because we're from Edinburgh. We decided to do a venue, just do it ourselves, in an old venue that we had performed in as kids when we were at school here.
Okay.
To do the whole experience of we're not going to be part of the whole... We'd always done the Pleasance, that had always been our kind of gig.
Okay.
And then we thought, no, let's just do it ourselves and go back to the Churchill Theatre. And post Absolutely and Don and George, we were well known enough to do that people would go to wherever we were.
Because so Don and George was on TV in 93?
Yes, it must have been. Yeah, must have been. So maybe the Churchill Theatre was 94.
Maybe it was 94. That's because I don't think I was here in 93, but I definitely saw it and I started
researching. Don and George, it was broadcast in 93. So my whole shtick for this year is a lie. It's 24 years since I've been here, not 25.
Okay, people, we've got all we need. Let's move on.
Oh my God. Sorry, yes, 93 Don and George was broadcast at start, and 94 we came to the festival.
Because I saw it. So I probably still have Don and George on VHS taped off the telly. Yes. Me and my brother used to love it. And I will bend your ear about it. We'll get on to that.
Yeah, sure.
So it's interesting you said you thought you had previously been at the Pleasance and then you wanted to kind of rebel from that and do your own thing. What was the sort of cultural context? What did it feel like? Why rebel?
Well, it just felt like we wanted to also, you know, it was our hometown and we sort of wanted to be part of sort of generating a kind of audience somewhere else that wasn't in the big four, three venues back then, I suppose, and now four, that we sort of wanted to access an Edinburgh audience. It was already, even by then, it was beginning to get a little bit like an audience were coming in from out of town rather than being a home audience. So Edinburgh people would just flee the town.
Yeah, yeah.
People from all over the world would come in and go to see shows. So we were trying to access a Scottish crowd in an Edinburgh crowd, because that's how we'd started. So even though it'd only been 13 years since we started, it was already, we were feeling nostalgic. So
yeah,
that's
what
I feel now, you know, all these years later. And probably the straight answer is we got more money doing it ourselves.
Yes. Yeah. It's
you just, you know, you take all of it rather than, you know, a certain percentage.
Yes, rather than 60-40 minus another fee for tickets and minus another fee for something else.
Yes.
And all
no,
that
it's
kind
not.
Of stuff.
It's not somewhere you come to make a huge amount of money, is it?
No, right.
But that's not why you do it. It's just, you know, it's the experience of being part of this city and performing here. And it's just coming back to do it. I've just been questioning why I haven't been doing it, because I'm just enjoying it so much. You know, just the whole experience of just walking around my hometown again, even just that, even just being wrapped up in this place that I forgotten I loved so much, you know.
And why such a big gap? What else have you been doing?
Well, yeah, I just wasn't performing. I sort of gave up performing for many years. And sort of did writing and producing and stuff like that. And then I got asked to do a show called Scott Squad, which is up here in Scotland on BBC One Scotland, and which is a semi-improvised show about the Scottish police force. And I just find myself enjoying it. I was right in the middle of a take, and I hadn't really done much improvising before. So you get little scenarios, you know, you don't get a script. It's just, this is what's happening in the scene, and go with it. And I was halfway through going, why did I give up performing? This is just actually such fun. So I slowly began to get back into it, and then that character I was doing in Scott Squad took off. The show was very popular in Scotland, and all the different characters were, and so they asked if I'd do a one night at the Glasgow Comedy Festival. That was 2 years ago. So then you pull together a show to do an hour and a half of the Kings in Glasgow, and for one night, and you think, well, we should really do it a bit more and get it out. So I thought, well, it's a perfect time to come back to Edinburgh.
With that character, Cameron Mikkelsen.
Cameron Mikkelsen, Chief Commissioner, yeah.
I absolutely love the show, and something that I became, because it's not quite half enough, slightly more of him and a set from McGlashan.
And a set from McGlashan,
which
people
listeners will know from Absolutely. Something that really struck me 2 seconds in was maybe the youngest member of the audience, so I'll get on for that, but it was an incredibly local crowd. It was obviously kind of a Scott Squad crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was struck by how many of the in-jokes I felt like I was getting on rhythm. You know what I mean? I was kind of retroactively working out what jokes must have meant. Not just, you know, the Glasgow School of Art fire, for example, sensitively handled, very funnily.
Yes, twice, both characters deal with it. Right, let's really have a go at that. Hilarious episode.
Yeah. But I felt so kind of wrapped up in it. It was this incredibly warm show. Everyone was on side. Everyone was sort of getting all the references. And I ended up feeling like I was getting
a
lot more of the references that I was getting just because it was so well written.
Yeah.
The other thing that really struck me is what a kind of virtuoso performance it was. I see a lot of sketch comedy.
Yeah.
I see a lot of character comedy. But this character is so firmly...
Yeah.
The character is firmly embedded in you, or vice versa. And I was like, oh, I'm watching an actual proper actor.
Oh, that's nice.
Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean? Properly painting pictures with words, properly kind of... I mean, I interview comedians, not actors, for the most part.
Yeah.
I don't know that I quite have the vocabulary for it, but it was just note perfect.
Oh, great. Well, thanks. I'm glad you say that. Yeah, he's a fun character to play. And because it's improvised, because we do so much improvising, I'm quite comfortable in that character. So I know how he thinks. I know how he walks now. I just know. So when things begin to go awry, you can just start improvising and follow it round.
I wonder if that's it. Because you are, yes, you have such a facility for playing with people in the audience.
Yeah, completely.
But not in a sort of stagey way where we felt like he always does this. Just in a very limber kind of a way.
Yeah. That's good. It's interesting you say as well about the references. My kids were, they might even have been in the same night you were in, two of my children. I have twins who've seen little bits of it on online on Scott Squad and Facebook. And weirdly, some of it has a life on, you know, the BBC Scotland website and Facebook. And actually, my daughter got sent a clip from a friend going, "Well, you must see this guy playing a place." And I said, "It's my dad." But they were, and they said exactly the same, that they didn't get some of the Scottish references, you know, where's Gart Kosh and who's this and who's that. But we talked about it afterwards, going, it's the same that we all used to. An obsession of ours was watching The Simpsons when they were younger, and you know, you don't get every reference to some obscure little thing in America, some show, but you understand it's a joke because it's written so well, and you know the type of joke that you're dealing with. It's not a leap to, you know.
Mikkelsen is a really archetypal character. I felt like it's not simply the incompetent boss, although that's kind of an element of it.
Yeah.
But I suppose, what are the things for you that kind of drive the character? What are the main kind of touchstones of that personality?
Well, it's right back to, and I can't remember who first said it, and people always quote it about comic characters, that thing about the gap between who you are and who you think you are.
Okay.
I can't remember who said it, but it's a great handle on, comedy lies in the gap between who the character is and who the character thinks he is. And the gap, the bigger the gap, the funnier the character. And the gap in Mikkelsen is vast because he believes he's a truly great leader and, of course, is just incompetent. So he's very Trumpian in that aspect. I mean, again, that's what I think annoys people on the right in America is how funny people find Trump because his belief in himself is so misplaced.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
You can see that it absolutely frustrates the hell out of him. People don't take him seriously.
That's true.
Drives him crazy. And that's Mikkelsen. So he can never be wrong, which is also very good. It's always somebody else's fault. His plans are always ill thought out. And so he's just got all these kind of classic sitcom character tropes, really, even though Scott Squad is not a sitcom. It's a sketch show. And it's a mockumentary as well. That's what it is. That's what it is about him. His opinion of himself is wildly misplaced.
How much of his character is from you, and how much of it is from the scenarios and the situations presented to you? In the very beginnings of Mikkelsen, were you writing the scenarios as well as playing the part?
No. Joe Hewlett created the show, and then Rab Christie's the producer, and Noddy Davidson is the director, and they all write, and I write as well. Mm-hmm. But the process for the show is, and when we started, I was just given the scenarios, and so I wouldn't have any input in writing at all. But my input in writing became in improvising it. So then you're actually writing it. So some of the stuff you make up, and then that just goes straight in. But then the live show is more written. So I've written chunks of it then, and they've written chunks of it. So it's a kind of combination. So what happens, of course, like anything, is once they start, they might think, okay, the character's A, B, and C, and I take A, B, and C, but then I added D and F, and they go, actually, well, we like D and F, we'll go further down that. So then their writing becomes more to where I've taken the character, and my playing of the character goes to more where they're writing. So it all meets. It all meets in the middle.
Are there ever frustrations along the way? Are there ever things that you improvise that then get cut on the basis there?
Oh, completely. Yeah.
What sort of things have arisen that didn't suit the vision?
It's stuff where I go too far in going down the silly route, going down the stupid route, going down the Don and Georgie type, I've found this image amusing, or I've found this idea strange, and actually so the tension lies between the production going, we're going to make this as believable as we possibly can, that people watching it will go, oh, hang on, is this a real thing, and I'm just going to do a very silly thing that amuses me, and I can always tell because a lot of my stuff is interview, so the director sits and asks me questions and I just answer back, and I can always tell when
he's given up
there. Yeah, and it's just going, Why is he doing this? Because he knows that I'm not going to put this in the show. He knows that. And a perfect example, actually, and there was a big fight, and we eventually got a version of the sketch. One of the sketches is a student is making a film, and he's from the, you know, the Glasgow School of Film, and he turns up and he's asked my character, the chief commissioner, to do one line. The zombie invasion is now a whatever, I can't even remember, mm-hmm. but something about it. And of course, my character decides to elaborate. I think there should be more about this. That's not how I would do it. So I'm just playing with it, and then it's just the sketch is just hard cut of me suddenly. Why don't I do it as a Southern lawyer? You know, and start. I do declare it a zombie thing, and then what about a limp? He should have a limp. And I remember so clearly seeing in Noddy's face. I went, no, wait a minute, I've got a better idea. He's got two limps. I'd started walking with two limps, and Noddy just throwing his script aside, and just, you're wasting everybody's time. We're never going to broadcast that.
That's a really good example, because something I noticed in Mikkelsen was from the live show that I saw. Was his obsession with firemen?
Yes,
seems very similar to me, or not in a negative way. Yeah. But it seemed to have echoes of Mr. Don. You were Mr. Don.
Yeah,
were
I
you?
Was. No, I was.
No,
Mr.
you
George.
Were George.
Because
I could hear you saying Don.
Yeah.
The echoes in Mr. George's hatred of the Swiss.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a similar kind of, it's just a very Jack Doherty tone to go, Jesus, these firemen, and just kind of belligerently have a go at someone on the grounds of almost nothing.
Nothing, yeah. And also funnier because they're really admirable, brave people.
Yeah.
Far
exactly.
braver than he is, you know. And for him to just believe that actually they just sit around doing nothing all day playing Scrabble just seems to be an amusing idea. But it's sort of little obsessive hatreds. I haven't seen that connection, but you're right, yeah. And actually, so long since I've done Mr. Don and Mr. George, because as we've discussed, 25 years, that I'd actually forgotten that, he just hates the Swiss, doesn't he? And that recurs in a few episodes, doesn't it? I think his hatred of the Swiss.
And there's an like snow is mentioned at one point, and it's like, we'd get the gritters out. So this is Jack. Hasn't he got a wonderful voice? I love it. I love it. It's such a joy to listen back to this whilst reviewing the episode and the interview. His voice is just so rich and boomy and wonderful. I think I'm doing a decent job of managing to actually ask him questions rather than just sit there grinning at him. But let me know, info@comedianscomedian.com, if you have any suggestions for guests coming up on the show. And any other business, I am trying now that I'm not writing a new show for next year's festival. I've done 5 stand-up hours in a row, and it's time to take a little bit of a break from scribbling. So I'm trying to focus a bit more on the podcast. So there has never been a better time to suggest to me your things, people I should be chasing up, recommendations for stand-up you think I might be unaware of. And also, if you are a member of the Insiders Club, which you too can join at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, and for a regular donation of £2 a month or more, if you fancy it, you can be part of the inner circle of this podcast, and you can pitch to me suggestions for projects to put on the secret private podcast that is only available to members of the Insiders Club. Currently, there's a load of stuff on there. There's extra content from episodes with James Acaster, Mike Kaplan, Rose Matafeo, loads of... There's the whole of the as-yet-unreleased Alice Fraser live episode, which we did at a ComCom meetup, where 30 or 40 of us got together, saw Alice's show, and then we all did a live podcast with her. And that's not been released yet on the main feed, but insiders can get to it already because it's on the private podcast. So feel free to jump in there, comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Other things, I mean, it gets to the middle of the section of the show. I don't think Jack is plugging anything particularly at the moment, and I'm not trying to make you come to a live thing. I think, in fact, we've sold out for our live podcast with No Such Thing as a Fish at the London Podcast Festival this Sunday, the 16th of September. If you manage to get tickets for that, I'll see you there. I've been in that room, and it's a glorious 400-seater thing, and I'm pretty sure it's sold out. You might be in luck. You might be able to get something up in the circle. Or there are some kind of balcony seats, I noticed, behind the stage where you can look down on the action. Those are greyed out online, and I don't know if it's because they're sold or because they were unavailable for sale. But if you're someone up there, please don't be a sniper, all right? There's a love. So, also, I'm at Welwyn, at the Barn Theatre in Welwyn. You can have a Google of that. And I'm interviewing Garrett Millerick, who is a fantastic stand-up. I've been enjoying watch. He's one of those guys. He started a few years after I did, so he was someone that I encountered at gigs when he was a newer act. And it's been great watching him turn into a really powerful comedy presence. His show Sunflower
at the festival this year was really, really good. It was one of those ones where, well, I'm sure we'll talk to him about this. I'm doing a live one with him at the Barn Theatre in Welland this Saturday. So jump onto that if you can, if you're in the area. And then we'll be releasing that one on the podcast fairly soon. He really had one of those shows this year where I think he was aware. He was like, oh, I've got one of those shows this year that people are talking about, and loads of comics are coming to see it, and there's buzz and stuff like that. You know, like kind of a breakthrough show, maybe. So good luck to him for that. And I look forward to talking to him soon. Do get in touch with me at ComComPod on Twitter, at ComComPod on Instagram. Oh, God, I'm learning how to use Instagram, and I'm not very good at it, but I'm learning. I'm trying to make an effort. This is the year to do it. And I will be back to chat to you for a bit of a postamble after the show, so after the conclusion of this interview. So let's get back to Jack Doherty.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Let's flip briefly into your time as an interviewer. You were the you were the face of Channel 5.
I was indeed, 5 nights a week.
You were the vibrantly coloured face. I remember those vibrantly coloured strips. You were all over the country. That was a huge deal.
On billboards. That's the weird thing. My first son was 1970. He was 3 or 4. And there was a drive home from the theatre out to where I lived in West London, and we passed about 10 of these billboards of my massive face and just everywhere. And he was sitting in his little bucket seat in the back on the drive home going, "Daddy, Daddy." And I thought, this is what it must be like to be Saddam Hussein's son. You know, just whatever, as if your dad doesn't figure highly enough a presence in your world when you're 3 or 4 to have billboards of him all over town. It must have been a weird little thing. I keep meaning to talk to him about it, see if he's got any recollection of that.
Was that the kind of peak of your, if not your fame, but your exposure?
It was the peak of my exposure, yes. I mean, I've never been famous, but in terms of just people going, oh, it's that bloke.
Yeah.
Because I'm used to, oh, you're the bloke from Absolutely, you're the bloke from Scott's Gone, I really love comedy, and can we talk about it? So it's a very specific kind of people who are interested in what you're doing rather than, oh, you.
I saw your face somewhere.
Yeah. So that's a different kind of weird fame. But also, it was Channel 5. So, I mean, it wasn't a, you know, there was not a big viewership or anything. So it was still very
limited. For our younger listeners, that was a big special thing that there was going to be a fifth channel.
I know. 5 channels, young listeners. When I started, there were 3. That's how old I am. Yeah.
Did you feel a lot of pressure at that time to be the face of a new channel launching? I suppose in that situation, I might imagine one would either feel, God, how am I going to cope with this? Or finally, I get what I deserve. There'll be somewhere on that spectrum.
Yeah, no, in the middle of that, certainly not the second. No, it was, hindsight, having my life again, it was an intriguing thing to try, but we should have done it on really low key. We did a pilot in a tiny little studio with 50 seats, and it was much more lo-fi and sort of dicking around. And actually, we should have done that show because Channel 5 wanted it to be this big. We're a new channel. And you might remember we're going to have a Stripped and Stranded. There's going to be a film at 9 o'clock, and every night. And
yes. Because,
but they didn't have the rights to really any films.
Okay.
So there were shit films every night at 9 o'clock, and then yes. It was going to be a chat show. So it needed to look like it was a big, glitzy, glamorous thing. It's that old thing, you're going to tell a lie, tell a big one. We're a big, proper channel, but you couldn't be because it didn't have the reach and it didn't have the money. But in fact, our little show, I think, would have worked very well in front of a lo-fi, yes. scratchy audience rather than having to go to the theatre and try and make it a big light entertainment show because we didn't have the money. You didn't have the guests back then. You know, it was very difficult. I think we literally, a couple of producers went out to shadow one of the American shows just to see how they ran a 5 nights a week show. I think it was Letterman they went to see. And just came back panicked. They found out that literally Letterman's entertainment budget, i.e. on getting the guests town cars and sandwiches, was what we were making an entire week's show for. Oh, you know, so God. it was impossible. It was crazy, 45 minutes for Tuppence Halfpenny. But it was kind of a fun thing to have attempted and fun thing to meet lots of your heroes and stuff.
And why did they... Why you? Because I remember at the time seeing that going, is that guy from Absolutely?
I know,
why is he being a presenter suddenly? What was the...
Yeah, why me? Exactly. I had presented Edinburgh Nights from the festival.
Okay.
So I'd only ever done comedy. And then Edinburgh Nights asked me to do a show with Emma Freud. And she would do the serious interviews and I would kind of go out and do pieces and just meet people and kind of dick around a little bit. And somebody saw that and said, oh, well, why don't we get him to... So we made the pilot and I kind of just slipped into it without really thinking. You know, you kind of... It's like you lose your feet at the top of a hill and you're falling before you know what you're... And it's like, oh, okay, I'll do it. You know, without even thinking of it. And... there was a part of me that thought it would be like GMTV, that we'd all be sacked within a month and paid off. So it would be a great earner for me. But they insisted on keeping it going for 2 years. And I did have to, I was counting the days quite early in, actually.
Were you?
I was thinking, yeah, well, no, this is not for me.
Because?
Just because I'm not performer enough, I don't think, to do that sort of thing every night, to get jacked up, get the adrenaline going. I think the great... chat show hosts that we've had, like Graham's great and Jonathan and all, and you know, I thought Frank Skinner was really good when he was doing it. They're all really close on screen to who they are in life. They're heightened versions of that person,
yes.
But they're not. Whereas I had to sort of, I'm not a very, hey everybody, it's showbiz.
Sure,
I'm much more a writer and maybe a character actor a little bit, and so I just, you know, I was having to act the part.
Of yourself, as a chat show host.
And I couldn't really, it just didn't feel me.
And do you think the public ever realised that, or was that just a sort of a thing?
I think they probably wouldn't, if you ask the public, they probably wouldn't go, oh, that's the problem with that. But they would feel it. You know what it's like performing.
Okay.
You could, an audience will sense that something's wrong.
Mm.
And I think they would have sensed that it's a little bit forced, so this guy's not being natural.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and also we wanted to do shit that we just found, me and the producers found funny, you know, in a kind of Don and George way. We wanted to take the chat show and just mess with it, but it made people uncomfortable. We kept getting the research back to us. I kept going back to us going, look, we've done the research, and everybody just says, can't you just have a nice conversation? And we're going, no, we're so bored of doing that.
Yeah.
So we do things that I remember famously to have Martin Clunes on, and I said to Martin, okay, just whatever I ask you, just so I don't want to talk about that. So men behaving badly, I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to talk about that. And then we'll just sit in silence for a minute and a half. And then I've got sound to just raise a slight volume on a tap dripping.
Yeah.
And we just sat and stared at each other. Now, to me, that was hilarious. And I thought that's the whole show should be this.
Yes.
But
that's
the audience,
more sort of 11 p.m. BBC
exactly.
Two.
Exactly. And the audience were just saying, going, no, this is, oh no.
Oh,
it's
God.
All gone off the rails. And, you know, and also going, but we want to hear Martin Clunes talk about men behaving, which, of course, you do. And if I was in the audience, I would want that.
Yes.
I would want to hear him talking about that. But when you're doing it, you just want to dick with it. So we did.
You said you and the producers were on the same page with that.
Yeah,
you wanted to do something anarchic.
Yeah, me and the producers and the writers. Because we had some incredible, you know, we had... Cecil and Riley and Armstrong and Bain were doing writing for it back in the day. So we had some great writers. But no, they were all on the same page. It was, I think it was the slightly above that pay grade that were just a bit, can you get to stop doing this? But it was, It was fun. And every now and again, once a week, perfect. That would be. It's a great job, because then you'd have a laugh. You'd have time to do it properly, and you could mess around. But you know, the ones I liked was when Eddie Izzard was on, or Vic and Bob were on.
Yeah,
it felt my territory, so I could just mess with them. I found it harder to engage with someone from a soap opera or something, because I just didn't quite have access to their world to the same extent.
So, just going back to your territory, when you started out, can you just sketch for us the beginnings of Absolutely? Was that Absolutely the first thing, or was it the
Yeah, the Bodgers, the four Scottish guys in Absolutely, me, Murray, Pete and Gordy, were in a group called the Bodgers, which we started in 1980, actually, at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, where we are today.
Were there a lot of other sketch groups, like college sketch groups?
So we were all at school together in different years, and we'd all done the school review. We were the funny people, in inverted commas, in our respective years. And they were a little bit older than me, and they wanted to do a show. And there was two other guys who then dropped out of the group, but they set it up. They just wanted to do one show at the Edinburgh Fringe, because we were all fans of... When you grow up in Edinburgh, you suddenly become aware of this thing called the festival. Mm-hmm. And if you're interested in comedy, you suddenly go, oh, right. And this is particularly back then, before the internet, before anything, before comedy clubs, you'd go, okay, well, comedy is on television. It's famous people. It's John Cleese doing Fawlty Towers. It's Morecambe and Wise. It's whoever. And there's nothing else. So it's a world that's just away from your experience. And suddenly you go, oh, wow, there's these people who are not famous, who are just at college. And there was a lot of college reviews. So it was Oxford and Cambridge. Mm. So when I was at school, I went to see A Footlights with Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie, an Oxford review with Angus Deaton and Phil Pope and all that lot, and Rowan Atkinson and Richard Curtis. Mm. So these were really great shows. But, you know, of course, there were only 19 or 20 of these guys, and I was about, whatever, 15, 14. And suddenly you go, OK, well, that's a possibility. We can do something here in a world of no comedy clubs. So we formed this group and went and said, okay, we're going to be the people who are not... Because there's no presence from Edinburgh.
Mm.
Everybody just came from outside. And we thought, well, wouldn't it be good to... That was kind of our selling point. We're the local group.
Yeah, you know? Okay, yeah.
You don't need these Oxbridge types. You can come and see us. And we got an article in Scotland at the back of that. And then I think we sold out that first run right from the get-go. So we never had that struggle, actually, as the Bodgers.
Yes.
Struggle would come later, because it's just word got out and people came to see us. So that's how we started, and that was the four Scottish guys, and we did 5 years, I think, 80 to 85. Mm-hmm. And it just got bigger and we got better. I mean, then we got nominated for the Perrier twice, lost it to a comedy brass band in the first year, which still really, really, really pains me to say it. Comedy brass band. But then Theatre de Complicité won it in 85.
Yeah, and which is kind of fair enough.
Fair enough. I saw that show 9 times over that run.
Jeez, which show was it?
Well, actually, they won for More Bigger Snacks Now, but they were also doing A Minute Too Late, which was Simon McBurney, a story about death and grieving. But, oh, man, it was unbelievably good. It was just crazy.
It's so kind of exciting and tantalising for me, as someone who's been coming here 25 years, to hear, even when I was 3 years old, in 1980, it was all still happening.
Yeah,
there were
yeah.
sketch groups, there was rivalry,
there was all of that. And it was much more sketch groups. It was pre-stand-up. So
stand-up hadn't even really happened.
It hadn't really happened. The guys, the comic strip guys, were just, kicking off. I think Rick and Aid were in town 1 year we were doing it, so there was a little bit that moved towards that. But like the Perry, when we were up, it was us, the sketch show group, the Hank Wangford band, a comedy country and western band, the Frank Chickens, two Japanese famous performers, Paul B. Davis, who was a storyteller when Dave Cohen was part of his group, and the comedy brass band, Theatre de Complicité, which were just proper theatre now. I mean, they're kind of establishment, but back then they were out of L'École Jacques Lecoq, so they were kind of Euro clowns.
Okay.
So it was all that.
Even back then, the running joke at the moment is the comedians going off to Goliath, who trained Lecoq, and that's
exactly.
the new form.
Well, that's
of,
where they came. Yeah, exactly. That's where they were. God. They were at Goliath,
And there must have been, I have no idea if you'd be able to estimate how many shows were in town. Because it feels, in the time I've been coming, it has grown exponentially.
Apparently it's 3,000 now.
Something like that.
Hundreds, but not thousands. I would imagine there would be 300 or 400. Something like that.
And were there kind of prototypical versions of characters that then went on to be in Absolutely in the Bodgers?
Yeah, not really. It was more pure sketch comedy, not character sketch comedy.
Okay.
So it was more, here's an idea, here's whatever it was, you know. And, here's Macbeth done in 30 seconds, or whatever, you know, a sketch. So I don't think we had any recurring characters at all. And then we did a radio show, one series of a radio show. We got lots of complaints from the south of England that we can't tell these people apart. They all sound the same, what's going on. Is this one Scotsman or 20 of them? I can't work it out. And, so then we hooked up with Morwenna Banks and John Sparks.
Okay.
Cornwall and Wales to keep the Celtic thing going. And we were put in touch. We met them on the circuit anyway. But Alan Nixon, our producer, sort of got us all together and said, what about you guys working together?
Yes. So we did one. That's a cunning angle.
Yeah, cunning angle, exactly. We were kind of the non-metropolitan crew. And we all shared a similar, if not identical sense of humour, which was by this time driven more towards character, slightly surreal, non-political, non-television parody, not referencing anything kind of cultural at the end of the 80s, which had been a very political time. And I'd spent a lot of time writing for Spitting Image, so I was part of that world as well. But our natural instinct was towards slightly more towards a character-driven, surreal thing, which was kind of starting in the late 80s, you know. We were doing it, and then, you know, bigger acts like Vic and Bob obviously just came flying through the League of Gentlemen. So it all became a little bit more of that kind of stuff.
Are there any elements of that type of comedy that you feel you are, if not responsible for, that you particularly popularised? I feel like every kind of, if not every generation, but someone, every team kind of puts something into the pot that then goes on to take form in...
Yeah, I don't know, because you can never tell yourself if you've done that. But I think there might be a little bit of an influence in that return to a vague surreality, a vague kind of nonsensical thing, because all you can tell is when you meet performers who go, oh, I really liked your show, and that influenced it, like the League of Gentlemen boys said, oh, yeah, we really liked your show, and people like that, and, you know, the Mighty Boosh or something, you know, referenced it. And so you can only... But I think it's just in the ether, isn't it? Like, everybody starts suddenly moving one way, and then 5 years later, it's a kind of lad culture-y, men behaving badly kind of thing comes in, and Britpop, and it just seems to all coalesce around a particular
It's
movement.
Interesting when you say the League of Gentlemen, it's almost the palette is very similar. I remember, you know, sort of Frank Hovis, and it was kind of grubby living rooms. Grubby living rooms and kind of stains on the side of your mouth. that kind of aesthetic.
Yeah, that kind of aesthetic, exactly that. And the League of Gentlemen, much darker.
Sure.
I think they took it into, you know, kind of areas that I loved. I remember seeing the pilot going, oh, this is just perfect.
Yeah.
Loving it from the off. But you're right, yes, it was in that kind of world, a beigeness, a grayness, an oddness, what's happening behind those curtains in somebody's living room. You know, life is a bit stranger than you think.
And was that a reflection of the kind of non-metropolitan-ness, that it was a bit more that we come from further away places villages?
Yeah, exactly that, I think, you know. That you even something as silly and as stupid as Stony Bridge, you know, just being non-metropolitan, just became this, you know... It's just an odd group of people living in an odd town.
There's something...
But that could have been Yorkshire, you know. It could have been anywhere. Yeah. It was just that kind of...
There is something I often wonder if, from the point of view of an audience, from the point of view of a young person at home, 14 years old, watching it on BBC Two, whether there is something faintly heroic about people who've managed to make comedy out of the stuff that's just out the window. Because it's so easy to go, oh, glitzy American stand-up, London, you know, metropolitan... comedy.
Yeah.
And then there's actually something if you are growing up in Cornwall and someone is speaking about things that matter to you.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
And I say this to someone who grew up in Leamington Spa and was a bit like, there's a bit of this about.
Yeah, and I think particularly Morwenna and John had that kind of access to those kinds of characters that they'd seen in Wales and in Cornwall.
Mm.
You know, lots of Morwenna's characters, like the mad artist in the attic, and people she'd come across in St. Ives.
Yeah, okay.
You know, people just that you see in the street, and that's what that's what's great about finding that. Mike McGlashan being given to me in a pub, the George in London. Just
really?
Yeah, just a rambling, you know, wild-haired drunk Scotsman, you know, coming up to me and saying, see what you're sitting on there, son. The fucking, the chair, we invented the chair.
Genuinely.
And I just said, thank you very much, I'll have that. And just took it from there.
You may have invented the chair, but I just invented you.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Thank you very much. I could track him down.
And for people who aren't familiar with McGlashan, I think probably the if you search on YouTube for McGlashan cycling away from the border, that's the kind of keynote of that character.
That's the keynote, exactly. When you could say certain words that would be frowned upon now in comedy. But yeah, you're right. It's exactly that thing where you go, I'm not much positive, and this show is about people, the types of people that I know, the smaller kind of stranger, odder people. And also when you get your own show, like we did in Absolutely. And it's weird to think that we got it because we kept writing a script for Channel 4 and they would go, yeah, we like this, but we can't really see it. And so we eventually just said, listen, like the kind of, you know, the brazenness of youth in a way, and that we just went, okay, well, why don't we come into the office and we'll perform it for you? So we came in and did it in front of the Channel 4 executives. Imagine that, a small crowd, three of them.
Oh, my God.
And we said, so this is how it is. And of course, afterwards, you understand because, you know, it'll be, you know, John Sparks hums Greensleeves and does a strange dance.
We've got to get in the room with you. So
we've
got to
get in the room because as a piece of script, maybe the Channel 4 executives are going, I'm not sure we can actually commit to the £1 million for this series based on John Sparks will be funny dancing to Greensleeves.
Yeah.
But then you go, there you go. Now, of course, we could have done a big, maybe we should have done a show in front of an audience as well. But they said yes, and we went, okay, bang, here it is. And we got fired up, and we went for it. And they said, yeah, let's go for it. Which is crazy way of thinking, you know, that's how a television programme got made.
Yeah.
But that was it. So try that, kids. Barge the door down.
There was an element to Absolutely as well, which was kind of animation.
Yes.
It's one of the things that I remember, like one of my kind of, one of the things I think of when I think about you is the I Don't Care song with the faces kind of replaced with cartoon faces.
Yeah, yes.
Kind of the ocean levels
are
rising.
Yeah, Triffic Company. Tim Triffic did, the guys who, they did the, you'll know their style from the credits of Have I Got News For You.
Yes. So
those animators. And thinking back, there's two things that seem really odd, and again, the innocence of youth, although we were in our 20s, we weren't that young, was that we put in animation and that we linked so much of the show by, you know, going from one sketch to another in the most brazenly weird way that we could, and going, well, I think Python have probably done this, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And going, well, we don't care. It's just a form. And interestingly, that we had reached the let's link all these sketches together sort of independently, because I was only 7 when Python came out, so I knew Python through the records and I'd never seen it.
Okay.
I'd seen a film, obviously.
Yeah, my introduction to it was records.
Yeah, I knew the silliness of the but we had done all these shows at the Edinburgh Fringe, and when we started, it was classic Punchline Blackout, you know? Here, lights up, here's the next sketch.
Rummaging moving chairs. Yeah.
Who's striking the banana? All that kind of stuff. And we got bored of that, so then we gravitated to it. By the end, Mr. Hargreaves did it, which was our 85 show, was what they all linked one into the other in a way that was, you know, it was based on a play that went wrong, kind of. So, which is a good idea for a show. Guys, did you see our show? So we'd kind of come to that conclusion anyway, that if you're going to do a sketch, you'll link it together. Mm. And actually, in the end, it didn't seem that people went, yeah, okay. So what the Python did? Because actually, Spike Milligan had done it before Python. So it's kind of, it's just an interesting way to do that form. And I think maybe in a good way, we're a bit more, oh, that's been done in Britain, rather than, oh, you're just doing that particular type of genre. It's similar like whenever anybody initially attempts a chat show, it's always guys sitting behind a desk asking questions, it's been done. Whereas in America, it's just, are you good at doing that type of show?
Yes, enough. You know, there's enough profusion of stuff that
it becomes a genre. So people don't go, oh, he's sitting behind the desk telling me what happened today in the news. I've seen that.
Yeah.
You know, it sort of doesn't really matter. But yeah, the cartoons, that was, yeah. So, yeah, Tim and Tobin. Tobin, who's, may he rest in peace, Tobin's gone. But yeah, we just, Yeah, we just decided not to worry that these things, they might have echoes of other shows.
Yeah. So, and where, in the similar way, is there a kind of similar origin to McGlashan in Mr. Don and Mr. George? Or were those just your silliest selves?
They were just our silliest selves.
Because I was in a double act, not at the time, okay. But later. I was in like a street performing
double act. Okay.
And we drew a lot of... I think we were mostly influenced by the Dangerous Brothers.
Yeah, initially. Yeah, of course.
And when I say Perfect. Influenced by, we were 16. Our first show was just a direct lift in the street. And we were like, wow. But
no, it's good. Everybody does that. Everybody starts with the other people's stuff and then you find your own voice.
I think I could recognise that you and Murray as Mr. Don and Mr. George, it was almost like I'll put a suit on.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
And now I can just be daft.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, initially... It was just a way of doing silly kind of sketch ideas, maybe word ideas or whatever, that didn't really have a character. So we thought, well, if we give them to these characters,
yes, okay.
Then it will become a world. You know, so if you have a stupid notion like coming back with 100, having bought 100 razors because they were 3 for 2, so it's a bargain.
Yeah,
But I've saved so much money by spending more money. You know, you go, well, okay, well, you give that to these two characters, it becomes a world, and you put them living together, and then you do all of this. But I think the influence would be both that we're both sort of versions of our fathers, as a lot of our comedy was.
Okay.
Like Mr. Nice as well absolutely was based on that kind of strange Edinburgh authority thing. It's coming full circle back to Mikkelsen again. But, you know...
Mr. Nice, was he the character that said there's all things rational? Was that...
From the authorities.
Yeah.
He spoke in this strange kind of way. And that was that whole character was just based on a tiny little moment where my father, I would notice, would be just slightly posher on the phone.
Yes,
it was, you know. I'll go and book our halls. I'm inquiring about my vacation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And so that tiny little moment led to a whole character. So then you go, okay, well, let's just have a patriarch who dresses his kids in exactly the same way, who forces them to talk at the same time. You know, he's a fascist, basically. Again, that's a kind of League of Gentlemanly world.
Yeah, it really is, thinking about it now.
Nice,
yes, absolutely.
Kind of, you know, but a sillier version of that. So Don and Georgia, and then the ideas would come for them. And the status thing, obviously my character suddenly began to have more status and he had less status and all that kind of stuff. But it did begin just as an excuse to do silly ideas that didn't have a home.
It's interesting you say that because I think that was what makes it so quotable. Mm. When the Fringe Guide was released this year, there's a Facebook group associated with this podcast, a few thousand people in it. And I said, oh, I've seen Jack Doherty's going to be here. Yeah. And the amount of quotes underneath the post of like, would you like milk or no milk? And, you know, you can run but you can't hide your legs.
You can
and all
run,
of these
you can't hide
just
your legs.
Lovely little sectional things that it would, now you're saying it, would be kind of impossible to get a whole sketch out of that idea. But them as a sort of a grab bag for... You know, like a chum bucket. Here are all the bits, and
completely.
Just let them do all
and
the
bits. And that's what that sitcom was as well. We just unashamedly just were just going to throw jokes as quickly as possible. Had no sense. It's not going to be any rationale. It's not going to be set in the real world. It's going to be, you know, unreal characters in an unreal world. The one thing that never works.
Yeah.
But we're gonna prove.
Yeah.
But weirdly, some people absolutely love that show. It's a weird one. Some people just pass them by completely, including Michael Grade, then head of Channel 4. But I still meet people who love it, who really, really love it. And so it was, it was great fun. Great fun doing it, but
I suppose it gave me as a viewer it was sort of licensed to be silly.
Yeah,
I loved
completely.
How silly it was.
Yeah,
because
it's totally
it did
silly,
seem
yeah.
to have a consistent internal logic, even if the logic was this is all just it's not madness. Yeah. It wasn't chaos, but it seemed sensible in its silliness.
Yeah, yeah. And the plots would have an internal logic. They would go through, but you could just go anywhere. With them.
All of these are available to watch for free online.
I know. Terrible. Or you can buy them on iTunes. We'll get our 27 pence royalties.
I'll auction the VHS and give Jack a pound now.
Exactly. I'll sign it. Yeah, make it less. But it's weird because you do these shows and then, of course, you don't watch them again because you've done them and 25 years, 30 years go by. But, you know, I know other people's comedy much better than I know my own comedy because I'll watch the things that I like again. I'll come back, let's watch the Larry Sanders show again or whatever. And but you're suddenly you'll be in a pub and someone just the other month came and said, I hope you have sufficient underpants.
Yeah.
And I just You'll have to help me. You'll have to help me. I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm assuming it's something I said 25 years ago in a sketch, but
You just need to make sure that all of your catchphrases are broadly kind and endearing rather than having people scream, "Get to Falkirk," at you in the middle of the street.
Exactly. Which also happened.
So when that show finished, and that was after Absolutely had finished, I know Absolutely has kind of, there were sort of live reunion shows, were there?
Yes, the guys, I didn't join in those, but that was, radio shows. So they've done, the other five done two series, I think, and I think they're doing a third. I believe they are.
Okay.
But yeah.
And you weren't part of those because...
Yeah, I just didn't fancy it, you know, I just, it felt to me... I just didn't want to go back over the old ground in exactly the same way, you know, go back to do those characters in that setting within that group. To me, Absolutely, you know, was just, in my mind, it's that show that existed between 90 and 93, and I sort of wanted to leave it there. And I it's weird because I love it when things I like form, you know, I'll go and see the Specials or Pixies, you know, playing, and I think, oh, great, they've reformed.
Yeah.
But I just didn't feel comfortable doing it. And so of course I worried, is this the right decision? Maybe I should be doing it. And I was just beginning to get into Mikkelsen that time. I thought, no, I'm going to concentrate on the new stuff and leave the older stuff. But then of course I'm now doing McGlashan, which is an old character, but it's in a different kind of content.
Yes.
You know, we kind of updated him for Scotland in a Day, which was the Channel 4 thing that went on in the night of the referendum.
Okay.
That's why I resurrected McGlashan. It seemed, well, now's the time.
Yes, this fiercely nationalist
character. It's going to be so close. He's going to get so close to getting what he's dreamed of, this character's life, which is an independent Scotland. And I had the sense that it probably would just fall short, which comedically was going to be great for that character.
Yes.
Because it would kill him. So,
given the kind of the very deeply held political, I don't know what the word is, like how much of a huge deal that was in Scotland.
Yeah.
Did McGlashan, was there ever any concern that he might... I mean, was he funny enough that no side really was upset by you saying stuff? I think a lot of Scottish comics didn't express an opinion publicly.
Or
they really did.
No, yeah, you really had... I think, it was... the artistic community, was very much a yes vote. And I do know people who were in the artistic community were no, but they would never have admitted it.
Yeah.
It was like career suicide. And it was like... It did go great. It was like J.K. Rowling coming out and going, you know, she was going to vote no. And, you know, the cybernats just... went at her big time.
Cyber nationalists.
Cyber nats. Yeah. But no, McGlashan is... I think he's such an outlier that I don't think people are going, oh, this is a satire on, you know, real nationalism or anything. He's so extreme. And in this show, I make it very clear that he's not associated with the SNP. He's left the SNP because they're a bunch of idiots who aren't fighting every day for NDRF 2. Sure. So he's one of these guys... wrapped in the flag, who protests outside Parliament and sets up a freedom camp. He's one of those guys. So it's not people... I don't know. I mean, you'll always get someone who's going to go, how dare you?
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe the how dare you speak about this comes more from, oh, you're living in London. What do you know? Sure. I guess you might get a little bit of that. But you can't... I mean, you know, if you start worrying about... what people are going to say about you on Twitter, then you just, you just stop. Don't do that because there's no point. There's no point.
Yes, it's
just do what you like and just see what happens.
I think I think probably comics who've started in the last 10 years might be more sensitive to that because it's like Twitter and, you know, internet discourse is such a bigger part of people's
Completely.
Lives. I feel I've sort of had a relatively lucky escape that I just, I don't really, you know, I use Twitter as an additional email inbox and an occasional means of going, hey, I'm doing a gig here, you know, but...
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that this time. I've noticed my lack of social media presence doing this show. That actually, it's the first thing I've never thought of, but I don't even have Facebook, I've never thought of going on Twitter, and yet until this time, thinking, oh, that would be very handy just to have a Twitter account. Go, I'm doing the show tonight, and of course, that's its main.
I think
purpose.
It quickly becomes a ravenous beast that insists in order to have any visibility, you need to continually contribute.
And one night you'll be pissed and think, I'm going to reply to that guy, suddenly it all goes tits up.
Yeah,
but I don't know. I still might late to the party. I might still join Twitter if I continue performing live. I think I will because I think it's a useful.
And is that how are you? So how are you finding the Edinburgh Festival? The challenge of doing a show a night.
Completely loving it, Because the new challenge was to do a solo show, which I'd never done. Mm-hmm. So that was... that's odd, because you go, okay, well, you've got to keep your energy up for an hour. And it's quite a... You know, my glass is quite full on, so it's quite a, you know, a pumped show. And you dash off stage and, you know, you're used to thinking, oh, I'll just sit and watch Murray for 10 minutes. Oh, no, I won't. I've got to fucking change and get back out there. But I have to say, like the night you were, yeah, the audiences have been great. They've really been enjoying it. And even when it's, you know, you're full one night and then you're even, but even in, if you get a smaller house on Tuesday or whatever, it's still a great room to play. And they're really, so far, I haven't done 12, and I'd say we've had one bad one. And it didn't really connect. And the rest of them have been just about the best response I've had to anything I've done, which is nice. It's gratifying. But it's just the experience of performing again, I'm delighted that I'm really enjoying doing that. And the first 3 days I was questioning, going, shit, I'm nervous, and oh, maybe this is why I don't perform, because you can't kind of... I don't know, maybe all performers are the same, but, you know, you can't kind of settle. You can't kind of eat. and then you get out there and it's fine and the show's working and I'm settled into it, and the next 2 weeks I'll go and see lots of shows. And
yeah.
No, I've just been really, really loving it. It's great.
Is there... it's interesting that there was this gap in your performing life, and you said there, the experience of having a little moment of thinking, is this why I don't perform? Yeah. Is there a question for you over why you didn't perform for so long? Was it like, were you busy having children or...
Yeah, it was a bit of that. Lots of children and then just doing writing and doing some producing. But yeah, it's interesting now. I am questioning why I gave up. I think to an extent I fell out of love with it a little bit. And I think maybe part of that was the chat show. I think partly I felt a little bit of burnout after that, and then I sort of took a couple of years off, and then I found I wasn't missing it. I wasn't missing the performing. So suddenly I thought, well, I've just become a non-performer now. And maybe you just... the fact that I'm enjoying it so much now, maybe I did need that time off. But it was strange, around about that time, I got a little bit... I wouldn't say disheartened, but just a little bit weary of it, which sounds so strange, because you're doing the thing that you really love, but... I'd gone, so for 2001 I wrote a pilot for Channel 4 that I was going to be in with Merwenna and Peter Richardson and various other people. And I remember that we went to the BBC and they went, oh, great, but can you write two more scripts and we'll see where it goes? And I just remember thinking, I don't know. Either, you know, just either you want it or you don't. I'm not going to write two more fucking scripts, you know. And from the excitement of 10 years previously, you know, bursting into somebody's office in Channel 4 going, can we do this show? Something had happened, you know, to me in that intervening period. And I think maybe I just needed to get away from performing for a while. But then the break probably just became... the extended break extended. It's probably been too long, because that's the thing that I should have been performing. And particularly live. I've forgotten the buzz of live's great when it goes well. And obviously, last Sunday, I would have said something different when I had one of those nights. Okay. But I think you need them, because I'd done four and it had gone really well. And I was going, it's a piece of piss. I know how to do this. And then, right. You need that Sunday night to bring you up short and go, actually, I'm better concentrate a bit harder, yeah.
And did you do all the writing for this, for the one that you're doing?
For this show?
Yes, for this show.
No, not all of it. Wrote all of McGlashan, I think, apart from a line. And then it's Joe Hewlett and... Rab Christie, okay. Noddy Davidson and me, who've written Mikkelsen.
Okay.
So some of Mikkelsen is some of the greatest hits on the TV show.
Gotcha.
Some new stuff, some stuff written specifically for the live show. Yes. So it's just a mix.
Yes, the kind of Whiskey Galore element of it. With the
Yeah, exactly.
Grand. So what do you see happening for you in the next 10 years of performing?
Ooh, blimey. I've no idea, really. I never plan. Which is maybe a mistake. I've always been struck by people who have a plan. I've always been quite impressed. I remember way back early days having a drink with Eddie Izzard, and he had a plan. You know, he had a 5-year plan. You know, wow. And I think that's just how he organises his life. And even with political, I've got a political plan. I've got this kind of... And I admire that, but I just can't seem to do that. I'm on a whim. Right, I'm going to try... You know, let's do the Edinburgh Festival. Great, let's do that. Let's write this. So I would imagine... the next 10 years, I want to just keep trying to find something I haven't done before. And if that's in writing or whatever. So performing, there's a part of me, a tiny little part of me thinking, maybe I should do a solo show at Edinburgh just as me, which I suppose I'd have to call stand-up, I guess, which I've never done.
An encounter with, exactly.
And I've only ever done character stuff, but there's some material ideas you get. Well, actually, you know, that character ranting at the Glasgow School of Fire that you brought up, you could do that as a bit of stand up. You could do that as an attitudinal thing.
Yes,
you know. But I don't know whether that's just a foolish idea to do that or not. But I'm quite tempted by the fact that at my age, 56, it's not going to look like a career move. You know what I mean?
So
it's not like I'm 26, I'm going to be a stand-up comedian, you know, whatever. But I may never get around to it. But it's something I haven't done, so that's kind of intriguing to me. But then I haven't written a novel either, and I keep thinking I'll do that, so maybe these things won't happen. But I imagine it will be a version of what I've been doing, a little bit performing, a little bit writing, a little bit producing. That's it.
And are there any particular strategies that you use to overcome creative blocks? Like when you're writing, comedy?
Exercise, actually. Running. I go for a run. I live near Richmond Park. And
it's a cracking park.
Yeah, it's a cracking. It's one of the top parks. And it's very good for running. So I just go out and stop thinking about it. And then I always find in the middle of a run, it'll go, oh, right, there it is.
That's a really frustrating tip.
Yeah, I know, sorry. You've got to go for a run. You've got to exercise.
I'll do anything to fix this joke.
Yeah. It could be swimming, cycling. Creatively, it's to stop thinking about it and go and do something else, definitely. And pop into it. Or more and more now, improvising within. When I was writing, I used to be a bit more tied to the typewriter and just sit thinking. But now with the experience of Mikkelsen and that, and McGlashan. So, I mean, most of McGlashan was written by improvising. So just wandering around in my room at home shouting and just trying out bits and where does that go and where does that lead, and then quickly jotting them down. Distraction. Get away from, stop staring at the paper. But, yeah, for me, it's always seems to be fixed by a run.
Are you happy?
Yeah. No, very. There's suddenly in the psychiatrist's chair. The mood of the whole podcast, bang! He's coming out with the big guns. No, I'm fucking miserable. I'm Tony Hancock. I'm going to kill myself. No, sometimes I think I'm disappointed that I'm maybe a little too happy. That, you know, you should have a bit more angst to be really successful, and yet I'm not. I just, you know, I do this because it's fun. You know, we escaped. I mean, it's hard life at times because you don't know where the money's coming from and all that. But, you know, I was studying law. I could have been a lawyer. I got out, and that thrill's never quite left. This is a lark, you know? It's a lot of fun. You put on a wig, pretend to be somebody else. It's good. Yeah, no, I'm very satisfied.
But, yeah. Thanks, man. So that was Jack. My thanks to him for coming on the show. And as I mentioned, the Gilded Balloon Press Office and, of course, the Place Hotel. Thanks, of course, to Nathan Wood for editing this show, to the podcast consultant, Mr. Peter Dobbing. And thanks to Rob Smouton for the excellent new music. I hope you're enjoying it. Get in touch and let me know. info@comedianscomedian.com. We've had some very positive comments on that. It's an anxiety heist. I mean, I love it. Someone said it made them feel too anxious. And on the Insiders Club, I think someone referred to the fact that they loved it, but they felt they love the new music, but they felt a bit disloyal in liking it because the old music has obviously been with us for 6 years and has now been put out to pasture. That old music is very well and is now sitting perusing notebooks in the ComCom Memory Palace. Yeah, why not? The music is a character in the Memory Palace. This is getting very Doctor Who. So that's that for now. Do give me a shout at ComComPod on a variety of social media. Go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders if you'd like to join that inner circle and find out. You get much closer access to me. We're sort of all constantly live on a workspace app, so people are effectively chatting to each other, and I'm taking great part of that. It's like a sort of the Facebook group plus with a bunch of different projects coming on there, and you get to interview me about things that you want, and then I broadcast them on the little private podcast. So if that appeals to you, then please join up soon. And I think
Oh, there's a bit of an announcement coming up, but I'm not quite in a position to announce it yet. So let's draw a line under that for now and misdirect you with a wave of my hand as we go into the postamble. Coming up soon, I think... who's next? Is it Laura Lex? Is it Alex Adelman? Is it Janine Garofalo? Is it Mark Thomas? Who can say? Speak to you soon. And then in a postamble kind of way, here, this is not what I was going to talk about, but let's talk about this because, you know, I'm very keen not to simply wang on about my child. There's not much else happening in my life apart from parenting at the moment, but let's talk about this. I'm looking out the window at some scaffolders who are... Now, what are they doing? Is it going up across the road or is it coming down? I think it's going up. Did you know how scaffolding works? I don't mean in a sort of physical climbing the bits of metal kind of way. Do you know where scaffolders keep scaffolding? They keep it on your house. They put it up and then they leave it there until such time as they need it somewhere else. Because why would you take it down, drive it back to a depot and store it there? Why don't you just leave it on Stu's house and then wait many months for you to, oh, we're putting it somewhere in the area, let's move it there. And will they take it down if you ask them? Will they buggery? Have you been in this position? This is the sort of thing we need to get. I believe Joe Lycett is doing some new consumer affairs programme on the BBC. We should get him on this. Did you know about this? This is one of those things that as soon as it happens to you, you go, oh, right, this is one of those life things that you don't find out about. No one ever tells you. No one says, oh, you're going to get scaffolding, are you? Maybe we should start doing a regular strand or a column on this show where I go, here's another thing I learned about life that I wish someone had told me so that when I went into it, I could have not paid the roofer until the scaffolding had been removed. God damn it, that was a long... I mean, we got there in the end. But of course, it's one of those secret ways life works. If you're a scaffolder, it doesn't make any sense for you to bother taking your stuff down. Why don't you just leave it up, thus forcing the owner of the property to do what? Suggestions, please. I looked into it. I had a Google of it. And as soon as you Google, help, there's still scaffolding on my house, there are a bajillion people on there, consumers, disgusted consumers, who are very happy to say, the only thing you can do is get in touch with the scaffolders and somehow convince them that you're happy to take the scaffolding down yourself, store it off-site, key thing, at their expense. You've got to threaten them with going, all right, I'm going to charge you £400 to get your scaffolding back. And then if you can convince them you genuinely mean to do that, despite your absolute lack of skill with scaffolding and the fact that if you did try and take it down yourself, you'd probably kill yourself because it's incredibly dangerous and you don't know what you're doing. If you can convince them that you're crazy enough to do it anyway, or you know some people who are crazy enough and shady enough to take it away and nick it, then they'll remove it the next day. And if you don't know that, or you can't convince them, and you don't know the relevant parties, then you just have to live under some scaffolding for the rest of your life. Scaffolding. It's a metaphor for growing up. The system gets you because everyone who was here before you has been learning how to make the system work for themselves. And then you turn up, glistening and bright-eyed, into adulthood, and you go, oh, could you put a thing on my house so that I can... I mean, I've got my head around the fact it's going to cost me loads of money, but the top of the flat is just too tall for a ladder to get to. So please treat me well, life. Please don't stiff me over. Please don't build a metal cage around my house that I can't remove. Please. Was that a postamble? It'll have to do. Fucking scaffolders. And I should say, I'm sure there are really good ones out there who listen to this and are very kind and caring and do exactly as they're told. Are there? Are you a scaffolder? Have you been affected by the issues in this episode? Please send me an email, info@comedianscomedian.com, with the subject line, fucking scaffolders!
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.